Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars with West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. Hi, and you're on The Front Porch. This week, we're going to talk about the suffering of the white working class. Is it their fault, or are we blaming the victim? And joining me today is Rick Wilson, goat herder, hillbilly philosopher, proud liberal.
Hey, Scott.
And also Lori Lynn,
who is a lawyer and conservative columnist who tweets at WV Pundit. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And we're going to talk about this National Review story that came out. It's made a lot of waves. The writer's called Kevin D. Williamson. Chaos in the Family, Chaos in the State, The White Working Class's Dysfunction. In it, he describes the incredible support Donald Trump is receiving in white working class areas, including apparently West Virginia, especially in hard-hit counties where life expectancies are stagnating or declining. So here's the basic premise. I'll start with this. He says, talking about the white working class and their woes, that nobody did this to them. They failed themselves. The premise is essentially that divorce and chaos in the family led to the inability to get jobs and has led to declines in health and other indicators that white working class areas are suffering.
No, it's kind of like Church Lady and Saturday Night Live would be my response to it. Isn't that convenient? All these problems are the fault of working class people themselves and not the result of any kind of larger political, ideological, or social forces. So this guy is pretty, let's just say, unsentimental to the core. My favorite paragraph of this, and this, I did not write this, y'all, okay? The truth about these dysfunctional downscale communities is that they deserve to die. Economically, they're negative assets. Morally, they're indefensible. Forget all your cheap theatrical Bruce Springsteen crap. Forget your sanctimony about struggling Rust Belt factory towns. It reminds me of the Big Lebowski. Are you employed, sir? Do you have a job?
Okay. Is there some truth to this idea that we're not doing any favors to people who are living in depressed places if we make them believe that these places are coming back? Maybe his prognosis, what we need to do, is they need real opportunity, which means they need real change, which means that they need U-Haul.
Yeah, it's almost like this could be a lot longer. You know, he jumps from kind of condemning the white lower class communities to, you know, get out of Dodge. And that those are kind of two separate points. I mean, I think the latter is very relevant to West Virginia, obviously. You know, he talks about the guy in, I guess it's upstate New York, his hypothetical guy. And, you know, just there's no job where you are. So get on a bus and go to, I think he says, Pennsylvania, maybe.
Young men of Garbutt, New York, which right. is this hypothetical depressed town. Get off your butts, drive 4 hours or hop a bus 4 hours to the gas fields of Pennsylvania and get a job.
The thing is, the gas fields aren't generating a whole lot of employment. I mean, even in good times, there weren't a whole lot of jobs there.
Well, most of those jobs are going to people from Texas and Oklahoma anyway. I mean, yeah, that's the other thing.
Drive through a motel parking lot.
So gas fields aside, though, Rick, but I mean, there are jobs in places in the country. I mean, I get this is the kind of thing I sometimes think when we look at, say, you know, southern West Virginia where unemployment is really, really high. I mean, say you're a guy in your 30s who used to be employed in coal and you're on unemployment. Again, hypothetically, you're physically able to work. Say you got a kid, but you're not married to the kid's mother. You know, should you stay there or should you go to Columbus, to Pittsburgh, to Charlotte? It's not that far away. We're not asking you to emigrate. You know, you can come home on the weekends. There seems to be this resistance to that. And that's all tied up in, you know, the struggle to stay and I don't want to leave West Virginia. But, you know, you have people walking across Europe for better opportunity. It's sort of hard for me to say it's so difficult to move to Columbus.
Well, I think that has happened. When I was growing up, people used to say the 3 R's you learned in school were reading, writing, and Route 23 to Columbus. And then later it's reading, writing, and Route 77 to North Carolina. So people have been leaving. But I got to call this one, in the case of southern West Virginia, so many politicians are really, you know, cashing in by blaming all the woes of southern West Virginia on the Obama administration, the EPA, as if markets and everything else don't have to do with it, and then saying these communities are expendable. Why don't people get out of there? So there seems to be a little contradiction there.
You know, I mean, I think Syria, the reason people are walking out of Syria is because they have literally lost everything. And they're willing to risk their lives to go someplace else because they're risking their lives to stay in Syria. In West Virginia, I mean, first of all, you do have a lot of people that are doing that. They're hopping on buses and in the cars and they're going to other places and looking for work. It's happening all over the place. The other thing, though, is you know, people have families and lives. They have houses that Lord knows they can't sell now. I remember this story of a young single mother, a reporter from West Virginia Public Broadcasting, followed for 2 years.
I remember that.
You remember this? She was trying to do everything right. She got out of her abusive relationship. She went to community college. She had to hitch rides to the community college to take her classes. And then she got this opportunity to work at a factory. I think it was like a chicken plant or something in North Carolina. And she picked up and moved all of her five kids and herself to this trailer in North Carolina, which, by the way, was this huge effort for her to be able to get the money together to make this huge leap of faith. And I remember the story from Christmas in North Carolina. It was really touching. She was so happy. She bought her own presents for her own kids for the first time in her memory. But then her son, who was a teenager, I want to say like 18, 19, he had gone into work in the plant too. And at one point he got horribly injured and she had to quit her job to take care of him. What did they do? They pack up and they move back to the ramshackle place that they actually still own, where she has family and connections and the ability to take care of her now disabled son. It's kind of like, you know, the mafia a little bit. It's like just when you think you get out, there are all these things sucking you back in. And I'm not seeing, you know, Kevin Williamson in this article talking about having a little bit of help for someone like this woman to get out and stay out.
Williamson has actually written about programs paying people to help them relocate. Wouldn't it make more sense to give, you know, say my hypothetical guy in southern West Virginia, to give him, say, $5,000-$7,000 and to use this, you know, to go to Columbus. This will pay your rent for 6 months or whatever. It'll pay for your U-Haul to get there and help you get established. And wouldn't that be a better use of, you know, government resources than continuing, you know, to pay him unemployment or, you know, what to try to keep him in that community where there isn't any opportunity? Instead, it's really hard to structure these things because, you know, do you write someone a check? How do you ensure that they're going to actually, you know, stay there? And I think one question that Williamson poses, why aren't employers doing this more? Why are they resistant to helping people pay for relocate, you know, relocation expenses for people in white collar jobs is very common, but you don't really see it down the ladder.
One thing I was thinking about the case you're talking about, the family that moved to North Carolina. There's a great book by Jack London. I can't remember the exact title, but it's about what poverty is like, what living at the margin is like, and there's sort of this refrain that goes through it, and then it happened. Like, okay, they're going along, you're struggling, and then it happens. Somebody gets sick. Someone gets injured, there's a layoff, there's some hiccup that really sets off a whole downward spiral. The other thing I'm thinking about is there's a novel written back, I mean, it's set back during World War II about what happens when an Appalachian family relocates. I'm thinking of The Dollmaker by Harriet Arnau, you know, and it wasn't exactly
a picnic, yeah. And there's no guarantee. That's the other thing. And when people were making these moves in the 50s and 60s, even in the 70s and 80s, there were lots of jobs available for people in these other places that did not require an education. Not so much anymore. A little harder to find a job that can support your family, even in Columbus or Charlotte. You're listening to The Front Porch right now because more than 10,000 people are proud members of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Becoming a member is so easy, it involves making a donation of any amount at least once a year. Are you a member yet? It's easy to go to wvpublic.org and click that donate button in the upper right-hand corner. I want to talk a little bit about this idea of, like, why is the white working class in general having trouble? What's causing it? And again, quoting from the Kevin Williamson article in the National Review, he says, if you spend time in hardscrabble, white upstate New York. Why are we always hardscrabble?
Yeah, they need to retire that word, I think.
If you spend time in hardscrabble, white upstate New York or eastern Kentucky or my own native West Texas, and you take an honest look at welfare dependency, the drug and alcohol addiction, the family anarchy, which is to say, the whelping of human children with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog, you will come to an awful realization. It wasn't Beijing. It wasn't even Washington, as bad as Washington can be. It wasn't immigrants from Mexico, excessive and problematic, as current immigration levels are. It wasn't any of that. Nothing happened to them. In other words, they did this to themselves. If it had not been for all of the social changes, the divorce, the decline of the patriarchy, where men don't feel like they have a need and a role in the family. He says the welfare state is now picking up the slack so that women don't have to have men. If you don't have a job as a man, women are less likely to marry you.
Sure.
Right? And so that could lead to the decline in marriage.
And he cites the fact that women initiate more divorces than men do. So, you know, marriage being sort of optional from the standpoint of the woman, she doesn't need the male provider because the state is filling that role.
So if somehow, I'm trying to make this prescriptive, if somehow all these poor folk in, you know, upstate New York or eastern Kentucky or West Virginia, if they could suddenly get married, stay married, stop all the drug taking, then economic development would follow. Jobs would be there. Employers would swarm to places where you had healthy, non-drug addicted, stable family, working class people. That's sort of his prognosis. And I think he's got exactly backwards. I would argue, and he would argue against it, and he does. But I would argue it's the economic changes that came first. It's the lack of white working class jobs for people without college degrees. That happened first, and that led to women looking around and saying, I don't need this guy. Plus the fact that there were societal changes in the women's movement and everything, making it more socially acceptable.
Yeah, I don't think you could argue it's entirely an economic story. I mean, certainly the sexual changes, sexual revolution had some part to play in the weakening of marriage. I don't think you could argue otherwise. I mean, there was that, and then, you know, in the 70s when the divorces started, and it's interesting to look at divorce because it's increasingly less common in the very, you know, very well-educated professional class. Charles Murray has written a lot about this. He wrote a book called Coming Apart that looked at the divide between the white lower class and the white, you know, more educated. And, you know, those people are not divorcing. They're living almost like very religious people, although they're not very religious, but divorce is not very common. And he has this great phrase, which is, you know, that they're unwilling to preach what they practice. They're unwilling to say, you should get married, you should stay married, this is a good thing. They're very non-judgmental toward people who are not doing what they are actually doing. But what they're doing is allowing their families to be stronger, providing a stronger environment for their kids. And then you have this divide then further increasing.
How much of that is people who are well off and well educated are more likely to stay married because for the very fact that they're well off, well educated, and have more resources to keep a family together and less stress in their life? I mean, that might be a play on it too. If your life is constant chaos, and if, you know, your breadwinner all of a sudden loses his job and gets stressed out about that, I mean, those things can, I think, lead to divorce as well. And if your life is just easier, if you have money to be able to fulfill your needs, then maybe there's less stress and therefore less divorce. It's a chicken and egg thing. Well, Rick, what do you think about all this? And by the way, can I just say, whelping of human children with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog. If you said that about black people or other people of color, that would be roundly condemned as racist. For some reason, it's okay for us to talk with such disdain about working class white people. But go ahead, Rick.
Okay, I don't know if we can say BS on the front porch, but I would call BS on the author. And thank you for making sense a while back there, Scott. I mean, the writer does have the ability to turn a phrase like when he refers to Trump as a giant pulsing humanoid middle finger. I mean, give him that right off the bat. But when you're talking about the kind of family and things like that, there's this thing called a market revolution, which has been traced back even to the 1800s when the family structure shifted from people being raised to be, especially men, to be independent entrepreneurs, farmers, to being employees dependent on other people. And that there's sort of a breakdown in all that as more and more things become commodified, and as changes in the economy come, it kind of undermines the basis of that family as a solid, independent economic unit. So, and again, looking at West Virginia, there's data that shows in the late 70s and early 80s, people here had higher than average wages in general. They were more likely to have health insurance from their jobs, more likely to have pensions. And then, you know, that was the time when Weirton Steel was their biggest employer. As we know, now it's Walmart. So there's been this tidal wave of economic changes.
I do wonder, too, like at what point, how far do people have to go? Should we clear out all of West Virginia because it's an economically failed state?
There was nothing in McDowell County before coal, right? I mean, even the Native Americans didn't
live there. About 2,000 people live there.
I mean, there was it was not a place. It was not an economic center of anything, right? And then so you have coal come in, and it got very big. Now coal is gone. You're not going to have office parks in McDowell County. It's just not suited for that. So what are you going to have there, you know, other than tourism, which will, you know, will support, it's again, you're not going to have a big resort there either. It's so rugged.
You make a good point. I mean, I guess what my frustration is that Kevin Williamson has written other articles talking about helping people to make transitions. And there's always talk about this. I've been in West Virginia for 20 years. There's always been talk about helping people get from point A to point B, but there's almost never any actual help or very little of it that would help people if they wanted to be able to get from point A to point B. So that's the frustration for me. It's almost like if we're serious about that as an idea, then why as a country don't we help? Instead, what's really fun and easy to do is to just basically blame the people for their own circumstance. I mean, that's the easiest thing because then you can write them off. Hasn't that been happening in Appalachia for 100 years now? It's their own fault they're in trouble. Therefore, you don't have to worry about them or do anything really to help them. You can just sit there in judgment.
Well, I would say what's not helpful, and I mean, he gets at this a little bit, is Donald Trump. He says the white American underclass is enthralled to a vicious, selfish culture whose main products are misery and used heroin needles. Donald Trump's speeches make them feel good. So does OxyContin. I mean, I think, you know, he does make them feel good because he blames their problems on, you know, China and immigrants.
And that's what it is. It's his pulsating middle finger. He gets that right.
Yeah.
But by us giving the rest of the nation a pulsating middle finger, it just reinforces their lack of respect for us and lack of ability to have to think about us and our problems.
I mean, there are other pulsating middle finger states around the country, obviously, or we wouldn't be having this conversation. But to pick up on something, in terms of history, I mean, going back to the whole blaming people thing, if you look at Russia, say, in the early 1900s, when there were hard times, it was really easy to misdirect hatred at the Jewish ghetto and have people go there and burn down a synagogue and destroy a Torah. You know, in the American South, someone did a study looking at the price of cotton and the number of lynchings. And when cotton prices went down, sometimes lynchings went up. I mean, it's fairly common for people.
Is the anti-immigrant sentiment, Rick, is that what you're talking about? Immigrants, according to Kevin Williamson, and I think a lot of other people, aren't the real of the economic distress that people are feeling.
Well, they're certainly not here in West Virginia. I mean, we have very little immigration into West Virginia.
We have the smallest number of foreign-born people in West Virginia of any state.
And I think it's really easy to redirect aggression, to displace aggression. And it's kind of hard and takes a lot of guts to take on people who are extremely wealthy and powerful. It's relatively easy to discharge that aggression downward at people who are relatively powerless, which is why a lot of people like, to be honest, like to bash people on welfare, like to bash immigrants, like to bash African Americans and others, because it's easier and doesn't have the cost that taking on the ruling class does.
But Donald Trump's people are, I mean, they're directing their aggression both up and down, right? They're directing it down at immigrants, but also up. And they're very angry at, you know, the Wall Street bankers who caused the housing crisis and, you know, the elites. He's constantly bashing the elites, the media. So I wouldn't say they're entirely aiming down. They're certainly angry at the top as well. And he stokes that.
Well, let's take what is basically sort of a screed, but let's take the idea seriously. There are two main ideas in here. One is that chaos in family life is seriously hurting white working class people. It's a new thing. It hasn't always been this way. And then number two, the solution to some of these problems is to help people get out of these communities. The communities are not going to be saved. Lori, if you could wave a magic wand and use all of the forces of the media and the business community and the government and everything else to have an impact on the family life in West Virginia, especially among low-income people.
How would I do that, or would I like to do that?
Well, I mean, obviously, wouldn't we all love it if people were getting married more often in happy marriages and sticking together? So that's a given. But what can we do about it?
Yeah, you there's very little that you as government can do about it. And one thing, and I think Murray alludes to this in his book, is the culture. You know, I hate to be one of those conservatives that, you know, like the Phyllis Schlafly kind of, you know, the culture is so toxic. But my goodness, if you turn on the television, I mean, my children are not going to be watching Keeping Up with the Kardashians, for example. They're just not. I consider that to be trash. You know, what my mother would call trashy. If you grow up watching that sort of thing, a culture in which that kind of thing is revered is not going to be one where marriage is necessarily strong.
How about you, Rick?
Well, there's several things I'd like to respond to there. One is, like, kids watching trash. That could include, like, some of the primary debates today. Talking about debasing public discourse a little bit. The other thing I'd say about that whole sort of trash culture that's out there is that these things are commodities that are highly profitable. And if we subscribe to an ideology that the pursuit of private profit is the highest good, then you're going to have a corrosive effect on a whole bunch of
Well, and they're also things. Produced by wealthy white people in California who probably go home to strong marriages and families themselves.
So maybe there needs to be sort of this idea that it's not okay to debase marriage. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but how on earth do you propagate them?
You know, I think it's tough because you don't want to stigmatize people that are single parents. Sure. And you don't want people that are stuck in abusive or miserable marriages to feel like they have to stay together. So how do you walk that line?
I think you try to make a kind of economic base that makes a thriving family life possible. I mean, that's one thing that's declined dramatically over the last 20 or 30 years. The other thing I'd say, you know, we're going back to West Virginia, the whole failed state thing. Mm-hmm. My snarky remark is, we may be a failed state, but we're a highly successful mineral colony. And it's, you know, you trash a place and then blame the people who are there for still living there. And then you create a narrative that if somehow the black guy goes away, we'll have 100,000 coal jobs here anymore. I mean, there seem to be some contradictions there.
Well, and if you want to have, and I think it's been proven that having free enterprise and the ability to shut down things that aren't working and open up things in places where they are, it's better for the economy as a whole. But the compact has always been that you're going to have programs and help for people that get the individuals that get hurt by those decisions. And I'm not entirely convinced. I know that there's some money for job retraining and things like that, but I don't think that there is a real honest effort to help the people that have been hurt by these changes. Not enough to make a difference.
When you listen to the prescriptions for how we're going to help, it's always we're going to help these communities. And what Williamson would say is you don't want to help this community. This community is dying. What you want to do is help the individuals to get out of the community.
So for the lack of an honest conversation about is this community savable or not, because we can't do that.
Well, because you can give someone job training, but if the goal is to keep them in place and there is no job in the place where they are, that effort is going to be doomed.
You know, I just think we all need to have honest conversations. I'm not sure a firebomb like this helps that. I think there's good stuff in here, and I think there's truth in here, but you walk away, when you have language about whelping of human children with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog, that's not opening people's minds to the possibility of change.
Yeah. I still kind of like that giant pulsing humanoid middle finger thing, too. That's an image to get out of your mind, West Virginia.
So. I would make this point, too. There's been a lot of anger directed at this piece from all sides, but also on the right. And I would say it's been an article of faith on the right when we've looked at downscale urban communities, specifically urban blacks. Well, you know, personal responsibility is really important. You have to look at the toxic culture. And I don't disagree with a lot of that. I think that obviously personal responsibility and cultural change has to be part of the conversation. But if you've espoused that for years, and then when somebody says that about your own community and it makes you very angry, I think you have to ask yourself why the very different reaction there. And that's a conversation that the right is having right now.
Rick, what's your Bible verse for the week?
I'd like to switch to Shakespeare if I could. But
whoa.
There is a lot of talk. We sort of talked about the issue of blaming, you know, people for their situation. There's another way of looking at that I wouldn't disagree with. This quote comes from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. To the extent that people put up with things that are intolerable, they do cooperate with their own oppression. And when you withdraw that cooperation, you actually change things and something else happens. So the quote is, the fault is not in our stars, but in ourselves that we are underlings. And that is to the extent where, you know, you're willing to take it or you want to do something about it.
I do think that it's a, you know, we talk about a lot about empowerment, especially in the 90s. That was the word empowerment by liberal people. And it's very disempowering if all your problems are created by this economic change and you have no agency to fix it yourself. In my life and my children, I try to install this idea that you do have power, you do have responsibility, you can change things for yourself. And I think we do a disservice if we try to tell people that you can blame the economy or you can blame the toxic culture. And, you know, well, no, you have responsibility too and ability to change things too. I think the problem is when we put it all in one of those baskets. It's all that person's fault. You know, it has nothing to do with the economy. It has nothing to do with larger forces.
I would say the working class, if you look back in history, has been the major force for positive social change. Going back to the days of the Revolution, when holding out for free public education all the way up to basic protections, living wages, and things like that.
Well,
so
maybe the new Trump
I wouldn't write off working people.
Administration will be this glorious new dawn of working class change. This is all.
Maybe it will be the pulsing middle finger.
Yeah. Don't bet against the middle finger.
And that's The Front Porch for this week. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. You've been listening to Rick Wilson of the Middle Finger and the American Friends Service Committee. How would the...
That's a good juxtaposition.
How would the friends feel about
some
that?
I'm going to get some phone calls from Philadelphia.
It's not very Quaker of you. And Lori Lynn, conservative columnist and lawyer. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Hey, and one more thing. If you're listening to The Front Porch, you like podcasts. I know you do. I love them as well. Check out Inside Appalachia. It's our weekly hour-long show of everything great happening here in our region. Check out Us and Them by Peabody Award winner Trey Kay about the divides culturally in America and how we can kind of straddle that divide and learn more about people who are different from us. Great podcasts, all available on iTunes and wvpublic.org.